Get ready to listen, learn, and earn CE hours. This podcast features content from an accredited CE activity provided by Calibri Healthcare. Visit elitelearning.com/podcasts for accreditation and disclosure statements and instructions on how you may be able to earn CE credits.
This is Dr. Candace Pierce with Elite Learning by Calibri Healthcare, and you are listening to our Elite Learning podcast, where we share the most up-to-date education for healthcare professionals. I want to welcome our listeners joining us for today's discussion about patient-first language. You may also hear it as person-first language. So joining me for this discussion today is Dr. Mariah Ward, a family nurse practitioner. Dr. Ward, thank you for taking time to join us for this discussion today.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I am excited to be here.
Okay. Can you share a little about your background and how patient-first language became an area you were interested in?
Yeah. So I've been a family nurse practitioner for about 4 years. I'm currently in a postgraduate certificate program for psychiatric mental health as well. And I am really passionate about patient first language because I identify with the opposite of it, which we'll talk about a little bit in the podcast, but where I am autistic. And so I don't really use person first language because it's so integrated into my personality and who I am. And so I am really passionate about it from the opposite end of it. But there's lots of really great reasons as to why you would want like first language and all of that. So I'm kind of like passionate about it because of the way it falls onto to me as an individual and kind of coming from my perspective, how that comes off. And, you know, I know that other people don't necessarily want that. So it's kind of like, I'm on it from the opposite end, but I also kind of understand why it's a necessary evil to change that.
Sure. And it really seems like patient first language is a newer healthcare topic, but I don't think it really is, because I kind of did a little research before we met today, and I saw that in 1986, the American Psychological Association actually adopted first person language into its publications. And now we're starting to see it become more and more popular in healthcare. And I know I've seen even billboard advertisements and commercials, especially with diabetes, about patient first language. So I'm really interested in what you have to share with us today. So what is patient first language and the origin and the history behind the move towards person first language?
Yeah, so patient first language, like you said, maybe called person first language, kind of emphasizes the person before the diagnosis, like disability or condition. And so it kind of humanizes, right? Instead of defining somebody by their illness, like an epileptic or a schizophrenic, it focuses on the individual. So it's saying a person with whatever disorder. The approach kind of looks to reduce stigma and highlight that a person is more than their medical status. Like you mentioned, the APA is really probably the fuel behind the fire for it, because you know there's a lot of stigma with mental illness, and if we're kind of defining people by their mental illness, there's people are less likely to get treated. I mean, there are still people that I see who are like, I don't want that I'm a bipolar on my chart, because they really think that starts to define them. So it's not surprising that the APA kind of tied into that, and really the movement started by advocacy efforts, like by disability rights groups in the mid 20th century. So right about the time that you were kind of talking about, they, you know, argued that labels created negative stereotypes, and dehumanized people with disabilities. So it became like increasingly adopted, and it's even codified in laws like the American Disability Act of 1990 and endorsed by style guides, which is what you mentioned, the APA, and organizations in the medical and social sciences field. So like the APA is there, they are a style guide, but they're also, you know, the people who write the DSM, they're really prevalent, especially in the mental health community. And even in, you know, APA guides are what we use in science. So most nurses and medical professionals are going to be really familiar with APA. And so when they take that, they kind of guide the practice and guide what we do, they're really going to be it's going to be kind of prevalent and important that we like follow their guidelines. And so, you know, and I even think about the most recent change to the APA where they emphasize that using singular they, them for mm-hmm. pronoun identification was appropriate clinically, you know, was stylistically appropriate. You know, that really changed a lot of conversation that people were having in academia of like, okay, well, this actually is something that we can do. And this is, so it's really like this movement kind of emphasizes that it's okay to talk about people first and kind of, like I said, it humanizes us and makes us, reduces stigma and stuff like that. So it's really awesome.
So you have a doctorate after, you know, you got DNP after your name. I've got a doctorate. And so we've written a lot using APA style guides. And I didn't realize until this conversation, until I was preparing for this, that it was, that that was the reason why that change was there, that it was for that person first, patient first language. I didn't realize what it was. I just thought it was the normal for formal writing. So it's really interesting to kind of hear the history and the background of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when I was in nursing school, condition first terminology was mainly what is used. And sadly, because I was so used to that, I was conditioned to that being the way. I really didn't realize the impact it had on perceptions and stigma and bias. What was the reason behind shifting from condition first to patient first terminology? Where did the thinking come from?
Yeah. So we kind of highlighted that it reduces stigma. You know, when you put the condition first, it perpetuates these stereotypes and like creates like a sense of otherness or outsideness. Mm-hmm. So person first in language acknowledges that the condition, but it emphasizes that people aren't defined by their health status. So it's not a diabetic patient, it's a person with diabetes. So you can take the first part of that, a person, and still kind of remove all of that. But like a diabetic, there's no removing that. So you're mm-hmm. tied indefinitely to this illness. It respects its individuality. So it places the person before the condition. It humanizes the individual. It recognizes that they have life, experiences, and identity behind their diagnosis. Again, you can't remove anything from the diabetic, right? But you can remove the person from the sentence when you say a person with diabetes. And it also empowers patients. So it shifts the language to reflect the philosophy like of disability right movements, where people with disabilities are seen as active agents, not just merely passive recipients of their labels or treatments or diagnosis. And that's really important when we're talking about long-term health outcomes, you know, because you can get better from an array of disorders. And, you know, your diabetes can be controlled. That's maybe not even a fraction of what your life is. So it's kind of important to empower the patient to remove themselves from the disorder too.
Absolutely. So how has the use of person first language evolved over time, especially in the healthcare setting?
Yeah. So I think
it seems like it's been a very small evolving or short. I mean, it's taken a long, long time.
Yeah. There's a joke in academia that, research starts and then it takes about 20 years for adoption, right? So we research it and do all that. And then the research itself takes years and years and years. And so, and then it takes us about 20 years to adopt it. So we're slow moving in the medical field sometimes.
Yeah.
It's evolved, you know, we've increased awareness and adoption. Person first language has become more widely recognized as respectful and inclusive. A lot of healthcare organizations, professional bodies, and educational institutions promote its use, but we still are not the best at it. The challenges of it, you know, there's a general move towards it, but its implementation is inconsistent, like you said. Some medical terms are inherently condition first. So, and there might be preferences within specific communities. Like I mentioned before, autistic people like to be called autistic. And so that kind of changes. And, you know, patient first language continues to evolve, especially in broader conversations around disability rights and inclusive language in healthcare. And it's a dynamic process that requires sensitivity and adaptability to ensure respect for individuals. And I think, too, just having people within the community that you're in, like the medical community, that are advocating usually for themselves first. You know, we're not just advocating for patients, you know, because a patient sometimes seems like a distant, far off person, but your colleague, it's a lot closer to home. And so I think that that's one of the ways right now that's really kind of helping gain momentum is, are people talking about their experiences within the medical community, people who work there, not just advocating for patients who seem maybe far off and distant to some of us in the
right.
in the field.
Do you have some examples of how word order and language really impact the perception that healthcare providers or other even other people might have on a patient?
Yeah, so it's like, it's a label versus a description, right? So using the condition as a noun to define a person like a diabetic, it conveys permanence and centrality. And like I said, you can't remove anything from that. It's there, it's permanent, right?
Right.
Whereas when you say a person with diabetes, it focuses on the person and it acknowledges that this condition is just one aspect of their identity. You can still take a person away from it and that's they're not attached to their diagnosis. There are negative connotations, so things like non-compliant, difficult, they can create judgment, blame, which impacts how a care provider views and treats a patient. So like if there's anything that says non-compliant on the chart, you might be treating somebody a little differently than if there was nothing like that on the chart. So focusing on behavior, so having difficulty following the treatment plan, it's more neutral and opens possibilities for collaboration. It also kind of emphasizes that there's a difficulty outside of their control maybe that's contributing to that. Instead of saying the person's not compliant, it's saying, oh, they're having difficulty following the treatment plan, but why are they having a difficulty? So, right, you start asking more questions. And then it's empowerment versus passivity. So, you know, phrases like suffers from the cast the patient in a passive role. When you use patient like living with or managing a condition, it recognizes the individual's active role in the disease. And so it also kind of encourages them to cope with the situation that they're in. And kind of, again, take themselves from the diabetic to a person with diabetes so that they can remove themselves from the condition and kind of live that life a little more comfortably.
When you were kind of going through through the word order just now, I was thinking about when I was at the bedside and I would take report. You would take report from your peers, your coworkers, and specifically, they would say, well, this person is really hard to handle, or this person is non-compliant with what I'm telling them to do. And so I feel like it kind of switches that, it kind of switched my thinking about that person before I even met them. Mm-hmm. And I tried really hard not to walk in there with a judgment of this patient is going to be hard to deal with today. And I really recall a situation where I was in ICU and this person was getting ready to go out to the floor. And they're like, they've been on the call light a million times tonight. I keep having to go into their room. And so I walked in there and I introduced myself and I asked them what they needed. And then when I left, I told them when I was coming back. And not once did they hit the call light. Because I came back when I said I was going to come back. But you know, if it could have been somebody else and we're like, oh, this is a really difficult patient and you walk in there and you see them treat someone differently because in your head, that's who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, we take away from the person by saying things like that, where it's like, you know, they've been on the call light all night. I'm not sure what's going on with them. You know, when you humanize them, it gives them a little bit of that, you know, that touch of, it gives you that touch of empathy and sympathy. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, yeah, it's like, okay, so you've had a challenging night with them, but you're not really sure why, right? So it's not just blaming the patient. It's just saying, you know, right. something's not right. Something's like amiss. Because like you said, you know, you really, you know, that can set the tone for how you walk in and how you provide care to the person, you know, and so you want to avoid that as much as possible, too. And because sometimes it's just like, it's, we're not, you know, oftentimes when we use condition first language or, you know, where we use
problem first language.
Yeah. Problem first language. Yeah. When we use that, we kind of like set these patients up for failure because we are just, we're blaming them And the reality is that oftentimes it's not them that's causing the issue. It's that it's them living with that condition, right? Like we have this dementia, demented, agitated patient, right? Like if we say they're demented and we say that they're, you know, agitated, it kind of puts the blame on them. Whereas if we're like, this person with dementia is experiencing agitation, like it's, we kind of tie it more into the dementia, right? It's more of the dementia's fault that they're agitated and less the person's fault that they're agitated. Like they have no control that they're agitated. Like they don't, you know, and not saying that patients can't have control, but that it's that sometimes it's not, it's that there's other outside factors that we need to think about first.
Absolutely. And especially with patients who maybe it's not about a condition. It's just about the fact that we're, as a nurse that day taking care of them or a physician that day taking care of them, we didn't do what we said we were going to do, or they didn't know. So because I would tell this patient when I was coming back, if they needed something and it could wait, they would wait until I came back rather than be on the call like every time they needed something. So it was a change in what I was doing that had a change in what they were doing because they knew they could depend on me and I was coming back and I was going to fulfill their needs. But I think that when we label them, oh, this is a hard patient to take care of, then the next nurse that comes in and the next nurse that comes in, it can affect the care that they receive and how they're thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I think too, it's, you know, when we put the emphasis on them, it kind of empowers them to take back some of that control over it, right? They're not just succumbing to whatever condition that they feel like they're in. So I think it's a good thing when we focus on putting them first.
Absolutely. And then maybe evaluating ourselves to make sure that we're not part of the problem as well.
Absolutely.
So how does first person language reflect respect for the individual and acknowledge that humanity that you were talking about beyond their medical condition?
Yeah. So kind of like we've hit on, it focuses on the person, right? So we're putting person first. We're emphasizing that they're more than just their diagnosis. It reinforces that they have hopes, dreams, relationships, and experiences that extend way beyond their condition. It also avoids dehumanizing them. Kind of, again, like we talked about, it's condition first language can feel reductive. It's, you know, defining somebody entirely by their illness. Whereas person first language helps counter that and, you know, recognizing the complexity and the wholeness of the person. It also separates the identity from the condition. So it acknowledges that while the medical condition is part of someone's life, it doesn't entirely define who they are. So it's like it helps preserve individual identity and dignity and encourage patients to continue to utilize that kind of idea of like, well, I am an individual. I have this, but I also like to hike. I also like to crochet. I like to do those other things. So they can also be a person who crochets, a person who, whereas like a diabetic, you can't really have much you can't have other hobbies, right? And interests.
Right.
When you're kind of in that area.
Absolutely. And there's so many dimensions to who we are as a person and what we have to offer and bring to the world rather than just being stuck on a condition or even a label, you know, combative or annoying. That's one, you know, oh, they're annoying. So I think it even goes beyond just condition, but to also how we label them when we give report or when we, you know, send them out of the hospital to the nursing home. It really does bring us a stigma and a bias as well, not even just the condition.
Absolutely.
So I know that there's some ongoing debates around person first language, which I was really surprised whenever we were kind of talking about this, is I didn't realize that there were arguments. So what are some of the ongoing debates around this and arguments from both sides?
Yeah.
What are the sides?
Yeah. So like I mentioned kind of at the beginning is like there is this identity versus stigma. So like some advocates of identity first language, specifically like in autistic communities or deaf communities, it's like the argument is that conditions like autism, deafness, blindness, we are inseparable from that, that personal identity. And so we are trying to embrace it versus distancing ourselves from it. Person first language can sometimes minimize or had a core aspect of who they are. So like that's a really big, especially in the autistic community, that's a big argument that I see even from just patient perspectives, not even from a provider or healthcare provider perspective. So then, you know, there's also this individual choice. So like, so sometimes the choice between person first and identity first language should be up to the individual. And imposing one style over the other kind of takes away some of that autonomy from the person. So both terms can be valid depending on personal preference and the context too, right? And so the other arguments, you know, can be a medical necessity. So sometimes conditioned first language is unavoidable for clarity, precision in the diagnosis and treatment discussions. This debate centers around finding balance between these practicalities and respect for the individual preferences. So amongst colleagues, you may be sharing, this is a diabetic patient who's, you know, it's a lot shorter than a person with diabetes, right? So sometimes, you know, brevity is important, especially when we're trying to convey something in an urgent manner. And then, you know, there are nuances within communities. So different communities have different preferences. Much of the disability rights movement favors person first language. But like I said, the deaf and autistic communities really prefer identity first language. And that's, you know, a lot of that is just because we can't take ourselves from that. We can't fray those edges. Like I'm autistic all of the time. Like it impacts every aspect of what I do. And the same thing for somebody, you know, who's deaf. You know, a deaf person is always going to be deaf, and it impacts every aspect of their life. And so sometimes it's more about, this doesn't take away from me, but when we try to take me away from it, it's like, that doesn't make sense, right? So it's really important to ask for individual preferences too. And like, I always go with this, I go with the safe than rather be safe than sorry. And I always just call the person by their name.
Right.
You know, and if I'm going to talk about them, I usually do it in contexts where they're not going to be listening to it. And that, so it's really important for me. It's like, I'm going to call you by your name. And if you want me to call you an autistic person at some point in the conversation, that's totally fine. But I'm going to start by calling you your name. And I think that's really the first part of it, right? It's that we humanize people by just giving them, stripping down every label, right? And just calling them by their name.
So when you were talking, I was trying to pick up on the context where actual condition first language is more preferred. And I got it with like the blind and deaf community and the autistic community, but what about within that healthcare conversations, like with our healthcare team? Can you kind of help break that down for me a little bit?
Yeah. So I think that a lot of like when we're talking to our colleagues, we want to optimize our time together, right? Because maybe we, like, especially in nursing, when we're calling a physician and asking for orders, right? We may not really be able to say a whole lot of words. So we're going to say this for, you know, this is a diabetic patient, blood sugar is 40, you know, we've done XYZ. And so we're going to simplify the language for brevity purposes. And also, you know, clarity, there's not a lot of extra words. You're getting the most important part across, right? The patient's diabetic, they're experiencing XYZ. We need XYZ. And so it kind of shortens the amount of time that you're not wasting, but like occupying for that, for that provider or for whoever you're speaking to. And this is really important too, like during rapid response team measures, if you're transferring the patient from one section of the hospital to another, if you're trying to communicate with another healthcare provider about needs, and then even coordinating care between individuals, right? So you're going to sometimes shorten that language to make it short and sweet and concise and really emphasize brevity so that you are optimizing both your time and the other individual's time. And it's not really about, it sounds harsh, but it's not about the patient in that moment, right? It is, but it's really about what's going on with the patient. And so
getting the information to the person that needs it immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it's a lot easier And it just saves us time and effort and energy when we're communicating in that way versus just taking all of the time for person first language. Not saying that we shouldn't do that, especially in patient facing interactions, but in provider to provider interactions, it's going to be a lot simpler to err on the side of brevity and conciseness.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about stigmas. Are there certain stigmas associated with certain medical conditions when it comes to language?
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of hit on this when we talked about the APA being who kind of initiated this change in the community. Right. You know, mental health are really heavily stigmatized. Terms like crazy, psycho are used really casually, usually in a derogatory way. This perpetuates harmful stereotypes. And creates an environment where people are hesitant to seek out help and disclose their diagnosis due to a fear of judgment. Addictions are kind of similar in that way. Substance use disorders can be termed like addict or junkie, and it carries this heavy moral judgment and dehumanizing of the individuals. And it can act like a barrier to seeking treatment, contributes to negative attitudes towards these people in recovery. And the other, you know, especially infectious diseases too. So diseases like HIV and AIDS, they carry these significant stigmas, terms that are associated, they can be weaponized to shame and ostracize individuals. And even though in the medical field, people with HIV have a ton more of a life quality. And so that's kind of one of the things that it kind of takes away from those individuals. And then, you know, two disabilities, it's like, you know, both visible and invisible, you know, stigmatizing language exists, and, you know, outdated terms and languages that focus on the deficits rather than the ability really undermines the person's sense of self and perpetuates these, you know, ableist attitudes. And so I think it's just about moving into a safer kind of place for most of these individuals. And kind of emphasizing that they are separate from their diagnosis.
Right. And we know that stigma is carried, but I mean, when we think about carrying the stigma, is it the patient, the provider, both, the community? Who's carrying that?
I think it's both, right? So, you know, when we use person first language, it avoids labeling people by their condition. You know, it promotes more nuanced understanding of like those individuals. It humanizes them, right? So they're more than just the illness. We emphasize their humanity and experiences, and it fosters empathy and understanding instead of judgment and pity. It also empowers them to the person's strengths and agency, combating these feelings of helplessness that the stigma can create. And, you know, we kind of talked about it where providers may hold unconscious bias or even conscious bias influenced by this stigmatizing language, right? So non-compliant, where we kind of already have that idea of what the patient is going to be like and what they're going to experience. And so I think it's really, it's on both, but I do think the provider carries, or not the provider, the patient carries most of that burden. But the providers do too. And we kind of hit on that earlier about, you know, it changes the way we view a patient if we just change that language around a little bit.
Right. Well, and I think it's not even our view, but I mean, go back to HIV and AIDS and what you were talking about with that and a stigma is carried with healthcare providers. You see that on a chart and you kind of get a little anxious if you're the one taking care of that patient. But does it change anything that we do?
No, it really does. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It really shouldn't, because all of our standard precautions that we already have, that shouldn't change at all, really, other than we become more hyper aware of the potential, I think. Had we not known, we would still be doing the same thing. We wouldn't be hyper aware. And so you definitely see that stigma and that bias in that moment.
Absolutely.
Hard. It's hard to not have that as a healthcare provider and to know that, you know, but absolutely. Well, Mariah, we've come to the end of our first episode. There was a lot of information to unpack in this first episode around first person language, but it was really good, insightful information. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
To our listeners, I hope you will join us for episode 2, where we will be discussing how first-person language really affects that patient-provider relationship.
This podcast featured content from an accredited CE activity provided by Calibri Healthcare. Visit elitelearning.com/podcasts for accreditation and disclosure statements and instructions on how you may be able to earn CE credits. Take your learning to the next level by subscribing to more podcasts on compelling healthcare topics. Thank you.